Okay. Today is August 28th. It's our first Mishle class. And we are discussing the introductory words about our Choveret. It has all of Sefer Mishle towards the end with a put into what we call modern parlance. Right? You'd be surprised how many dozens of Psukim and Mishle have made their way into very famous modern from, let's say, Ben Franklin, or, you know, famous aphorisms and famous parables of quick one-liners. So it puts it into relief for you there. And because we remember, this is a work written thousands of years ago, so meanings of words change significantly over time. It's just amazing that since Hebrew has been used without cessation since the time of the writing of these books, it's true, Eliezer ben Yehuda is going to have to write new words for a modern state of Israel, right? They won't find a word for sweater or umbrella or television in the Tanakh, right? However, that being said, the Hebrew language has been used nonstop, even by Yiddish speakers, because they have to read the Tanakh, they have to read, the davening is in Hebrew, right? Most of the Sfarim are in Hebrew, right? They use some Aramaic sprinkled in, but it's all Hebrew, right? So even if they're actually speaking in Yiddish, Hebrew is a living language throughout our history, so that if someone knows Tanakh and they go to Israel now, they'll be able to manage their way, right? The same is true that if someone lives in Israel, he's 30 years old, never opened the Tanakh, just by being a Hebrew speaker, he's probably able to work his way through some biblical grammar also, right? Okay, so be aware that if in English we say forbidden fruit is sweeter, and in Mishle it's stolen waters are sweeter, we understand it's the same point, right? There's an amazing Gemara at the end of Nedarim. It talks about the very last lines of Maseches Nedarim. A man is committing adultery with a married woman. In flagrante, the husband comes home, right? So he rushes out of bed and he hides in the closet. And he is aware of the fact that there is a glass of poison on the dresser that looks like water. The husband comes in and he sees that from out the closet that he's about to drink it. And he calls out from the closet, "No, no, don't drink that, it's poison!" Right? And then he comes out and the husband says, "What are you doing in my house?" He goes, "Well, I admit I came here to do such and such, but we never did. We never got to commit adultery yet." Whatever the intent, in other words, trying to tell, your wife is not forbidden to you. So the last line of Maseches Nedarim asks, do we believe him or not? What do you think? She insists, "I didn't get around to committing adultery yet. I'm still permitted to you." He may not want to forgive her, he doesn't need that to divorce her. He can divorce her anyway, but he may choose to. But the question is, if he wants to stay with her, can he? Why am I telling you this now when we're learning this pasuk? The Gemara at first says, well, he must be telling the truth. Because if he really did commit adultery, yeah, surely he would want to drink that poison and die. So he's got three dibs on the wife. Why did he scream out? Because he's just a moral person? Right? Why did he scream out if he really wants the woman? So what's the last words? The last three words of Maseches Nedarim are Mayim Genuvim Yimtok. Maybe, just maybe, he wants her as a forbidden person, not as a permitted person, right? So the husband will divorce her and he'll marry her. He shouldn't. Doesn't matter. He wants what's forbidden. If he's ready to commit adultery, he's certainly ready to marry a woman he shouldn't be marrying as a losase, right? He's willing to violate Mrs. Beis Din over her. You know what I'm saying? So the Gemara says, no, maybe he wants her as forbidden. So when we look at, we'll analyze Pesukim and Mishle with a depth of human understanding. Right? It's old stuff. But you know what? When it comes to science and math, I want all of the whatever people are saying today, yesterday. Not last year, not 10 years ago, not 100 years ago. But when it comes to these analytics of the human condition, I'm ready to go back 3,500 years. Let me see what these old people have to say. Right? Okay, so understand that stolen waters are sweet. Doesn't ring with us. Forbidden fruit, that already harps back to Gan Eden. Right? You hear me? So forbidden fruit is already, so that's what these 31 chapters do for you. Okay, we're going to use them in order to, at times, obviously not go straight through, but when we want to give a sort of modern parlance to something. Okay, Hosea, for instance, says, the men are committing adultery like bakers. Really? How does a baker commit adultery better than a fisherman? I don't mean to be just concentrating on adultery this morning, but it's a terrible human failure. So what is he saying? So at first glance, I'm thinking that maybe he used baker because the word for baker in Hebrew sounds very much like the word for adultery. Maybe. Niuf ofer, you get it? In fact, the etymology of the two words may be similar. Right? You can use your imagination for that. All right, however, the Radak on the Pasuk in Hosea says, no, there's something else going on here. A baker's day starts at 4 in the morning. He's got to have the oven hot and ready to go to bake bread for everybody who needs it for breakfast. Right? So his day starts 3, he's waking up at 3:30, he's ready to rock in at 4. His day ends at 10, 11 in the morning when all the other men are out in the field. So he knows who's home alone, who's casing the joint. So he's trying to say that you're not just going after your urges, you're planning urges. Hitavutafa. That's his complaint. So all of a sudden, what seems to be an incomprehensible metaphor, you're committing adultery like bakers, now becomes already a whole new in you. Right? I tell you this particular example, and many hundreds of others like it, is because when you're reading something from 3,000 years ago, you have to put it into a modern context to really reach us. My audience today is living in modern times. I don't know if we have to sort of modernize, if you will, what the message is. Okay? And have it make its best sense. Now, if you look at the... I'll prepare this for you, but this shows us what we're going to do over time. All right? And Mishle is profoundly disjointed in its messages. What I mean is, you can have a message about Zrizus, how important it is to enthusiastically go about what you need to do that day, and make lists and accomplish them and make goals, right? And then the next pasuk talks about the pitfalls of envy. And the next pasuk talks about the pitfalls of pursuing kavod. And you expect that in Pirkei Avos. So this rabbi says X, and that rabbi is going to say something totally different the next pasuk. But wouldn't it be better if Mishle just had one pasuk on envy, or one parak on envy, one parak on the typhus of addiction to substance abuses, which is plenty of Mishle. Have different gates of different I use the word gate because there's a famous work that does this on Mishle. It's called Orchos Tzadikim. You've heard of it? Very popular in the yeshivas in Israel now. Orchos Tzadikim. There are these Orchos Tzadikim Siddur at night in Musar. It's allegedly written by the Rosh, but most scholars say we really don't know who wrote it. Right? It's written at the time of the Rosh. It seems to be a generation right after Ramban, perhaps. But the Orchos Tzadikim categorizes and puts into, I think it's 37 altogether, 37 different gates of topics that he culls from Mishle. Of course, he takes some from Pirkei Avos also. Take some from the Rambam Hilchos Deos too, but it's mainly taken from the world's oldest book of self-help and improvement, right? I will tell you that the Alcoholics Anonymous, you're familiar with the 12-step program, right?
First, but they have a 12-step program of self-improvement, which is largely based on Tehillim, right?
But there's plenty of Mishnah in there too. I take this as a slight segue now to compare three works in the Tanakh where Mishnah fits in. One is Koheles, according to Chazal, the same author as Mishlei, and Tehillim. And we would characterize these three books as Koheles being a very pessimistic type of sefer, right? What should we strive for? We're all dying anyway. How are we better than any animal? We're all dying anyway. The righteous die, the wicked die, the smart die, the foolish die. So what are we striving for? Who's going to remember us? Anybody in this room remember anything your grandparents, grandparents did? What are we for? How are we going to be remembered 100 years from now? What is it? What are we all striving for? Okay, a few important points. One is that seven times in this book, he reminds you, what can you do? These are we're not going to have answers to these things. Just echol b'simcha lachmecha. Just eat your bread, enjoy life. He says, find a good woman, make a family together, and enjoy the good things in life. It doesn't mean that these bad things, pessimistic things, are going to disappear. What it means is that if you have some enjoyment in your life and some nachas, you'll better be able to deal with those things. Plus, there's a whole genre of commentaries. Even Ibn Ezra is among them. I say even Ibn Ezra because he's real Pashtun. But a genre of commentaries that try to see the silver lining in Koheles. Right? The opening pasuk in Koheles is, look at it on the board, Havel Havolim, Amar Koheles. Havel Havolim, Hakol Havel. Right? This, he points out to us, is not Hevel Havolim. That would be like most English translations render, vanity of vanities, all is worthless, all is vain. Right? No. Ibn Ezra says that this is a tzivui. You get it? It's a command. There's lots of hevel in the world. Right? Hakol hevel, he says. So Ibn Ezra says hakol means most things. You ever hear the saying, don't sweat the small stuff, and it's mostly small stuff. Right? That's what this pasuk is saying. If it's small, havel it. You get it? Treat it that way. Search for the minority of things which are worthwhile. The best things in life aren't things. How's that? Okay? And they're probably free. Okay. So, how about this one? You ever hear, we say this every day. Umosar ha'adom min ha'behema ayin. Man is no better than an animal. There's nothing, no mosar, no improvement, no possible betterment of a person over an animal, because we're both dying. We're both going to disappear into the ground. So what do we have over an animal? Really? Then he says, who knows if the spirit of a man goes any different place after he dies than the spirit of an animal? What spirit does an animal have? I have a spirit. I feel I'm going to continue to exist in some form after I'm food for worms, right? But why are you saying that there's no? What kind of pasuk is this? Digression. Chazal say that Koheles should be taken out of the Tanakh. You familiar? Well, Mishnah is all over Shas, in Medayim, in Ediot, in Gemara's, in Megillah, in Shabbos, and Koheles is not part of the canon of the Bible. Right? It got in because there are other opinions, but there are lots of opinions throughout our rabbinic literature that Koheles is not canonical. Right? that it contradicts itself, but when the Meiri has a commentary to Gwela, says, it's this pasuk that the Chazal didn't like. Because it's mamish kfira to say that when a human being dies, we just disappear into oblivion. We go back to the fire or whatever else. Right? That's not our way. Okay? So how do we understand the Mosar Adam? What is he trying to say? So Koheles says, I'm sorry, the Meiri says, in his parish to Koheles, that Koheles wants to solve the problems of the human condition using, he writes in Hebrew, Torah HaMechkar, which we might translate as empirical data. It is not empirical that our spirit continues to exist after we are no longer in this form. Therefore, he's not going to use that explanation, which the Talmud and the Zohar very freely use all the time, right? Olam Haba, reincarnation, etc., etc. But there's no empirical data on these things. I, the National Enquirer, was always writing about someone who's pronounced dead on the operating table, and then he swears that he saw this great light, and he went to his grandparents, and then they quickly brought him back, right? A whole day could last for a split second in your mind, right? It's because when someone is dead on the operating table, they do this and they put a blue light right in the eye. The brain interprets that. If he's brought back, which means he was never gone, but if he's brought back, the brain will remember something there. Right? They use that as empirical. I think they've even made movies trying to empiricize life after death. Right? Okay, but Shlomo didn't rely. He didn't see that movie. Right, so he's not going to use anything but empirical data to resolve life's inconsistencies. So the book looks pessimistic, right? If I wanted to be optimistic, I would tell you on this also. You see what the Ben Ezra did with the Havel Havelim? Let me tell you what I'm doing with the Mosar HaAdamina Behema Ayin Ki HaKol Haga. Listen. U'mosar HaDitz Chassidisha. U'mosar HaAdamina Behema. How is a man better than an animal? Ayin. Because we know how to say no. This new husband wants nothing more than to be intimate with his wife. But he knows how to say no. Because she's neither right now. I want this ice cream, but I say no. Not because my doctor says my cholesterol is sky high. That doesn't stop me. If I'm flacious, that stops me. Right? A three-year-old can get this. He's having a tantrum in the supermarket because he wants Lucky Charms because he saw it at a friend's house, doesn't keep kosher. And he's screaming. The parents says, what am I going to do with it? He says, you can't have it. It's filled with sugar and cholesterol. No, it's not kosher. Let me tell you, when you become parents, the tantrum stops when they know it's not negotiable. The tantrum will always continue. Every time you give in, that makes the next tantrum more difficult. But if they know Fleishitz and Milchitz, not negotiable. Kashrus, not negotiable. Shabbos, not negotiable. Right? So that's the difference. An animal doesn't know how to negotiate those differences. We do. Mosar ha'adam min ha'behema ayin yakol ha'adam. Get it? We know how to say no. And that's part of the message of the Mishlei. It's forbearance. Okay? Have you heard of Ben Franklin's 13 principles? Have you seen it? It is the exact same as Rabbi Yisrael Salanter's 13 principles. Who lived first? Ben Franklin was 70 years earlier. Question is, we have actually identified a particular person who knew both Ben Franklin and Yisrael Salanter. It's possible that he brought up. Now, it's also possible that Ben Franklin's 13 principles were publicized and well known. But I believe they're both in here, if I'm correct, because they're both based on Mishnah. If not, I'll get it for you in a separate. Because all 13 of those principles, forbearance, moderation, things like that, industry, they're all taken from Mishnah. Now, Mishnah is by definition a 100% optimistic book. Explain what I mean by that. Everything is optimistic. I found one very realistic. It's not an optimistic puzzle. It doesn't really belong here. We'll have to see how it fits in. Okay. Why is a parable of, we'll see different English words to possibly use for this, but the proverb, why is a proverb must be optimistic? Isn't that the whole point? You ever hear the early bird gets the worm? You've heard of that? In other words, don't stay in bed too late. You're going to miss opportunities. Right? So if you wake up early before the other birds are out, you'll have the pick of the worms. Okay, I get it. But sometimes an early bird gets up early and gets run over by a truck making an early delivery. You know what I'm saying? Does the early bird always get the worm? Maybe. Can't be sure. In other words, when Mishlei writes, the lazy man folds his arms and has nothing to eat. The man of industry, his house has food. Right? Is that true? Maybe sometimes the lazy man folds his arms, buys a lucky lottery ticket, and he has food for the rest of his life, and much more. And the man of industry breaks his leg and starves to death. You know what I'm saying? Mishlei is, this is what happens most of the time, play the percentages. Right? Life is filled with inconsistencies. Chas v'shalom, someone can leave this building and get hit by a brick before falling from the top of the building. Everything else is going great. Right? Life is filled with, but play the percentages. Yeah, that's what Mishlei is, and that's why it's optimistic. What's the one pessimistic pasuk? There is a pasuk in Mishlei that says, it starts off by saying, God's world works like a wheel, but some people die before their time. Some people die before their time. Sounds like a pasuk out of Kohelet, right? It is a pasuk out of Kohelet. But to put a pasuk like that in a book, which is, and I hope you can see what I mean now, right? Ipso facto must be optimistic in nature. A stitch in time saves nine. That means that's a bit of right? Just steady wins the course. Just stay in time, right? Okay, why nine stitches and not seven stitches? Because nine rhymes with time, so it's easy to remember. Okay, that's more like the Ofer Niuf thing I said before, right? But sometimes stitch in time, in your rush, you prick your finger and you die of an infection. Again, play the percentages, that's what Mishlei. The combination of these two can be demonstrated through Sefer Tehillim. This is not, of course, in Tehillim or Kohelet, but Tehillim has a fascinating array of prakim that run from the phenomenally faithful at chapter 38, where the meek shall inherit the world, the righteous shall inherit the world, the four different people who inherit the world. I'm not sure why. We just know about the meek doing it, but the fear of those who fear God shall inherit the world. And it's just every pasuk in chapter 38 is just such a profoundly faithful description of how sure we are that in the end, good wins out. But there are other problems like this until no doubt. But nothing, it's a long paragraph. Also an alphabetical paragraph. It's just that it doesn't go straight Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, Hey. It goes Aleph, and Fusil, and Bet. You have to see it in there. It's there. Not coincidence. It's an Aleph, Bet, Perek with Psukim in between. So it's not 22 Psukim, it's something like 38 or 40 Psukim. Right? But they're at the same time, I mean, this is a great, great faithful pasuk. He named Lo Yonum the Lo Yishan Shomer Yisrael. Very, very faithful, right? God neither sleeps nor slumbers. He has a constant eye open for me. Right? You know, there's another pasuk in Tehillim, chapter 42, that says, Ura Hashem Lama Tishan. Wake up, God, why are you sleeping? Tehillim is not a monolithic book. Just like if you want to compare, David's life is not a monolithic life. He starts his life in Stama with great disappointment. He's not considered one of his brothers, among his brothers. There are lots of psukim in Tehillim, the whole prakim in Tehillim, that talk about my mother's children despise me. Eved ma'asu habonim, my son Rosh Pinah. What do you think that means? B'nei min yicharubi. Right? In David, ki avivi imi azavuni. Ah, v'ashem yasvei. So Tehillim has profoundly faithful psukim and prakim, and some profoundly doubtful psukim. Okay. It can be shown that you can divide David's life into five periods. One, his youth. He describes why he thinks he can fight Goliath. He says, I was once tending my father's sheep, and a bear came to threaten him, and I killed the bear. Another time, I killed the lion. He feels he's cut out for something big. But it's a difficult existence because he's despised by everybody. Why that's so, there's some very creative midrashim, and Rashi writes in his Parish to Tehillim a few places. Why didn't Ishai call in David for a chance at king? Right? All the brothers are trying on the slipper to see if it fits, and David isn't even called in when Shmuel says, Ishai, one of your sons, is the next king of Israel. Why not? So that's the first stage. Second stage, after he's crowned, he kills Goliath. He's riding on it. That's maybe the best period of his life. Right? That's two. Three. Quickly, after that, Shaul becomes very jealous of him. And that may be the most treacherous part of his life. Right? He never mocks Shaul and says, make my day, Shaul. I'm supposed to be the next king of Israel. Go ahead, try to do something. God's will shall be. Right? No, David never lets on that he expects to be the next king of Israel. There's one time where apparently he does, but I'll let that now. So that's a third stage. It's very treacherous. Chapters 50 through 60 seem to be all during that stage, because those chapters actually begin many of them. So many of those begin with like an introduction. This is what Doeg did. This is that, you know. Okay. This is what Novel did. Okay. So that's three. Four is after Shaul dies and David becomes king. That's big time, right? That's four. Until Bathsheba. And then David's life after that is just everything that happens to him comes as a direct result of what he did with Bathsheba. And the rebuke of Nassam in chapter 12 of Shmuel Bet. So Tehillim, don't be surprised that if in the author of the book there are many different stages that are very different than others, like we have in our lives. This is before I met you, this is after I met you, okay? With you I have everything, without you I have nothing. Right? So the greatness of David is redemption. That we all sin. Chazal say that David was not the human specimen that Shaul was. That's what Beis in the Sechas Yuma. Shaul was a much greater specimen of humanity, much more moral than David, says the Gemara. So why does David's kingdom last? Because, precisely because of that, he wasn't so perfect to think that he can't say Chapas. The small sin of Shaul's remains because he doesn't know how to say, I did something wrong. David recognizes that. Okay, the Gemara says, "Ein ben David ba ella im kein yesh lo kupa shel shratzim unach mitzavrov." He has to have bones in his own closet. He's got to have worms. Can of worms stuck around his neck, so that he doesn't lord it over others and think himself too great. Right? That's the greatness of Tehillim, which is a combination of the above. There's pessimism, there's optimism. It's, I would call it, let's say, realistic. Again, it's a combination of this. Okay? That is our introduction. Okay? For today, It is August 28th. Okay, I look forward to seeing you on Thursday. This is where he needs to send us now. And you will always find the shiurim at yutorah.org. My name with the heading Mishnah. Okay. Have a great day, everybody.